the voice of Captain Sato on the tape, apologizing to the man as he killed him. After that time, the only voice on the tapes is that of the pilot. The cockpit tapes have been checked against other recordings of Captain Sato's voice, and also have positively established his identity. Third, forensic tests have proven that the co-pilot was dead at least 4 hours before the crash. This unfortunate man was killed with a knife in the heart. There is no reason to believe that he had anything at all to do with what came later. He was merely the first innocent victim in a monstrous act. He left behind a pregnant wife, and I would ask all of you to think about her loss and remember her and her children in your prayers. The Japanese police have cooperated fully with the FBI, even allowing us full access to their investigation and to conduct our own interviews of witnesses and others. We now have a full record of everything Captain Sato did during the last 2 weeks of his life, where he ate, when he slept, with whom he talked. We have found no evidence to suggest even the possibility of a criminal conspiracy, or that what this demented man did was part of some larger plan on the part of his government or anyone else. Those investigations will continue until every leaf and stone has been turned, until every possibility, however remote, has been fully checked. But the information we have now would be more than sufficient to convince a jury, and that is why I can give it to you now. Jack paused, allowing himself to lean forward a few inches. Ladies and gentlemen, the conflict between our country and Japan is over. Those who caused it will face justice. Prime Minister Koga has personally assured me of that. Mr. Koga is a man of honor and courage. I can tell you now for the first time that he was himself kidnapped and nearly murdered by the same criminals who started the conflict between his country and ours. He was rescued from his kidnappers by Americans, assisted by Japanese officials, in a special operation right in downtown Tokyo. And after his rescue, he worked at great personal risk to bring an early end to the conflict, and so save his country and ours from further damage. Without his work, many more lives might have been lost on both sides. I am proud to call Minoru Koga my friend. Just a few days ago, minutes after he arrived in our country, the Prime Minister and I met privately, right here in the Oval Office. From here we drove to the Capitol building, and together we prayed there. That's a moment I will never forget. I was there, too, when the aircraft struck. I was in the tunnel between the House Office building and the Capitol, with my wife and children. I saw a wall of flame race toward us, and stop and pull back. I'll probably never forget that. I wish I could. But I have put those memories aside as best I can. Peace between America and Japan is now fully restored. We do not now have, nor did we ever have, a dispute with the citizens of that country. I call on all of you to set aside whatever ill feelings you might have toward the Japanese now and for all time to come. He paused again and watched as the text stopped scrolling. He turned the page on his printed text again. Next, we all have a major task before us. Ladies and gentlemen, one man, one disturbed and demented individual, thought that he could do fatal damage to our country. He was wrong. We have buried our dead. We will mourn their loss for a long time to come. But our country lives, and the friends we lost on that horrible night would have it no other way. Thomas Jefferson said that the tree of liberty often requires blood to grow. Well, the blood has been shed, and now it's time for the tree to grow again. America is a country that looks forward, not backward. None of us can change history. But we can learn from it, building on our past successes and correcting our mistakes. For the moment, I can tell you that our country is safe and secure. Our military is on duty around the world, and our potential enemies know that. Our economy has taken a nasty shock, but survived, and is still the strongest in the world. This is still America. We are still Americans, and our future starts with every new day. I have today selected George Winston to be acting Secretary of the Treasury. George heads up a large New York mutual fund company, which he founded. He was instrumental in repairing the damage done to our financial markets. He's a self-made man, as America is a self-made country. I will soon be making other cabinet appointments, and I will report each of those to you as they are made. George cannot become a full cabinet secretary, however, until we restore the United States Senate, whose members are charged by the Constitution to advise and consent to such appointments. Selecting new senators is the job of the governors of the several states. Starting next week, the governors will pick individuals to fill the posts left vacant. Next came the tricky part. He leaned forward again. My fellow Americans? Wait, that's a phrase I don't like very much. I never have. Jack shook his head slightly, hoping that it didn't look overly theatrical. My name is Jack Ryan. My dad was a cop. I started in government service as a Marine, right after I graduated from Boston College. That didn't last very long. I got hurt in a helicopter crash, and my back didn't get better for years. When I was 31, I got in the way of some terrorists. You've all heard the story and how it ended, but what you don't know is that incident is why I re-entered government service. I enjoyed my life until that point. I'd made a little money as a stock trader and then left that business to go back to history, my first love. I taught history. I loved teaching at the Naval Academy. And I think I would have been content to stay there forever, just as my wife, Kathy, likes nothing more than to practice medicine and look after me and our kids. We would have been perfectly content to live in our house and do our jobs and raise our children. I know I would have. But I couldn't do that. When those terrorists attacked my family, I decided that I had to do something to protect my wife and children. I soon learned that it wasn't just us who needed protecting, and that I had a talent for some things. And so I joined the government and left behind my love for teaching. I've served my country, you, for quite a few years now, but I've never been a politician, and as I told George Winston today in this office, I do not have time to learn how to become one. But I have been inside the government for most of my working life, and I have learned a few things about how government is supposed to work. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a time for us to do the usual things in the usual way. We need to do better. We can do better. John Kennedy once told us, "Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." Those are good words, but we've forgotten them. We need to bring them back. Our country needs all of us. I need your help to do my job. If you think I can do it alone, you're wrong. If you think the government can fix itself by itself, you're wrong. If you think the government, fixed or not, can take care of you in every way, you're wrong. It's not supposed to be like that. You men and women out there, you are the United States of America. I work for you. My job is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and I will do that to the best of my ability. But each one of you is on the team as well. We need our government to do for us the things we cannot do for ourselves, like providing for the common defense, enforcing the law, responding to disaster. That's what the Constitution says. That document, the one I swore to protect and defend, is a set of rules written by a small group of fairly ordinary men. They weren't even all lawyers, and yet they wrote the most important political document in human history. I want you to think about that. They were fairly ordinary people who did something extraordinary. There's no magic to being in government.
I need a new Congress to work with me. The Senate will arrive first, because the governors will appoint replacements for the 91 men and women we lost last week. The House of Representatives, however, has always been the people's house, and it's your job to pick those, in a voting booth, exercising your rights. Here we go, Jack. Therefore, to you and to the 50 governors I have a request. Please do not send me politicians. We do not have the time to do the things that must be done through that process. I need people who do real things in the real world. I need people who do not want to live in Washington. I need people who will not try to work the system. I need people who will come here at great personal sacrifice to do an important job, and then return to their normal lives. I want engineers who know how things are built. I want physicians who know how to make sick people well. I want cops who know what it means when your civil rights are violated by a criminal. I want farmers who grow real food on real farms. I want people who know what it's like to have dirty hands, and pay a mortgage bill, and raise kids, and worry about the future. I want people who know they're working for you and not themselves. That's what I want. That's what I need. I think that's what a lot of you want, too. Once those people get here, it's your job to keep an eye on them, to make sure they keep their word, to make sure they keep faith with you. This is your government. A lot of people have told you that, but I mean it. Tell your governors what you expect of them when they make their appointments to the Senate, and then you select the right people for the House. These are the people who decide how much of your money the government takes, and then how it is spent. It's your money, not mine. It's your country. We all work for you. For my part, I will pick the best cabinet people I can find, people who know their business, people who have done real work and produced real results. Each of them will have the same orders from this office, to take charge of his or her department, to establish priorities, and to make every government agency run efficiently. That's a big order, and one which you've all heard before. But this president didn't run an election campaign to get here. I have no one to pay off, no rewards to deliver, no secret promises to keep. I will do my damnedest to execute my duties to the best of my ability. I may not always be right, but when I'm not, it's your job and that of the people you select to represent you to tell me about it, and I'll listen to them and to you. I will report to you regularly on what is going on and what your government is doing. I want to thank you for listening to me. I will do my job. I need you to do yours. Thank you, and good night. Jack waited and counted to 10 before he was sure the cameras were dead. Then he lifted the water glass and tried to drink from it, but his hand was shaking so badly that he nearly spilled it. Ryan stared at it in quiet rage. Why was he shaking now? The tense part was over, wasn't it? "Hey, you didn't puke or anything," Callie Weston said, suddenly standing next to him. "Is that good?" "Oh, yes, Mr. President. Vomiting on national television tends to upset people," the speechwriter answered with a hooting laugh. Andrea Price fantasized about drawing her automatic at that moment. Arnie Van Dam merely looked worried. He knew that he couldn't turn Ryan away from his course. The usual strictures that presidents listened to, if you want to get reelected, pay attention, simply didn't apply. How could he protect someone who didn't care about the only thing that mattered? "Remember the Gong Show?" Ed Keelty asked. "Who wrote this abortion manual?" his legal aide chimed in. Then all three men in the room returned their attention to the TV set. The picture changed from an external shot of the White House to the network studio.
"Well, that was a most interesting political statement," Tom, the anchor, observed with the expressionless voice of a poker player. "I see that this time the president stayed with his prepared speech."
"Interesting and dramatic," John, the commentator, agreed. "This was not your usual presidential speech."
"Why, John, does President Ryan insist so strongly on inexperienced people to assist him in running the government? Don't we need experienced hands to put the system back together?" Tom asked.
"Well, that's a question many will ask, especially in this town."
"You bet we will," Keelty's chief of staff observed.
"And what's most interesting about it is that he must know that. And even if he didn't, Chief of Staff Arnold Van Dam, as canny a political operator as this city has ever seen, must have made that very clear to Mr. Ryan."
"What about his first cabinet appointment, George Winston?"
"Winston heads the Columbus Group, a mutual fund company which he founded. He's enormously wealthy, as President Ryan told us, a self-made man."
"Well, we want a Treasury Secretary who knows money and the financial markets, and surely Mr. Winston does, but many will complain that he's an insider," Keelty smirked.
"With too many contacts in the system," John went on.
"How do you think official Washington will react to this speech?" Tom asked.
"What official Washington?" Ryan growled.
"This was a first. The two books he'd published had been treated generally well by reviewers, but back then you had to wait a few weeks for people to make comments. It was probably a mistake to watch the instant analysis, but it was also impossible to avoid. The hardest part was keeping track of all the TVs that were running at the same time."
"Jack, official Washington is 50,000 lawyers and lobbyists," Arnie pointed out. "They may not be elected or appointed, but they're official as hell. So is the media."
"So I see," Ryan replied.
"And we need experienced professionals to get the system put back together. That's what they'll say, and a lot of people in this town will agree."
"What did you think of his revelation on the war and the crash?"
"What interested me the most was his revelation that Prime Minister Koga was first kidnapped by his own countrymen and then rescued. By Americans. It would be interesting to learn more about that. The president is to be commended for his clear desire to settle things between our country and Japan, and I'd give him high marks for it. A photograph came to us along with the president's speech." The network picture changed, showing Ryan and Koga at the Capitol. "This is a truly moving moment captured by the White House photographer."
"But the Capitol building is still ruined, John, and just as we need good architects and skilled workers to rebuild it, so I think we need something other than amateurs to restore the government."
Tom turned to stare right into the camera.
"So that was the first official speech from President Ryan. We'll have more news as it develops. Now we return you to our regularly scheduled programming."
"That's our theme, Ed."
The chief of staff rose and stretched.
"That's what we need to say, and that's why you've decided to come back into the political arena, however damaging to your reputation it may be."
"Start making your calls," Edward J. Keelty ordered.
"Mr. President?" The chief usher presented a silver tray with a drink on it. Ryan took it and sipped his sherry.
"Thanks."
"Mr. President, finally, Mary Pat, how long have we known each other?" It seemed to Ryan that he was always saying this.
"At least 10 years," Mrs. Foley replied.
"New presidential rule, executive order even. After hours, when we're serving drinks, my name is Jack."
"Muy bien, jefe," Chavez observed, humorously but with a guarded look.
"Iraq?" Ryan asked curtly.
"Quiet but very tense," Mary Pat replied. "We're not hearing much, but what we are getting is that the country's under lockdown. The army is in the streets, and the people are in their homes watching TV. The funeral for our friend will be tomorrow. After that, we don't know yet."
"We have one fairly well-placed agent in Iran. He's on the political beat. The assassination came as a total surprise, and he's not hearing anything aside from the expected praise to Allah for taking our friend back."
"Assuming God wants him,
It was a beautiful job, Clark said next, speaking from authority. Fairly typical in a cultural sense. One martyr, sacrificing himself and all that. Getting him inside must have taken years. But our friend Daryae is a patient sort. Well, you've met him. You tell us, Jack.
Angriest eyes I ever saw, Ryan said quietly, sipping his drink. That man knows how to hate.
He's going to make a move, sure as hell. Clark had a wild turkey and water.
The Saudis must be a little tense about this.
That's putting it mildly, Mary Pat said. Ed's staying over for a few days, and that's what he's getting. They've increased the readiness state of their military.
And that's all we've got, President Ryan summarized.
For all practical purposes, yes. We're getting a lot of SIGINT out of Iraq, and what we're getting is predictable. The lid is screwed down tight, but the pot's boiling underneath. It has to be. We've increased coverage with the satellites, of course.
Okay, Mary Pat, give me your speech, Jack ordered.
He didn't want to hear about satellite photos right now.
I want to increase my directorate.
How much?
Then he watched her take a deep breath. It was unusual to see Mary Patricia Foley tense about anything.
Triple. We have a total of 657 field officers. I want to jack that number up to 2,000 over the next 3 years.
She delivered the words in a rush, watching Ryan's face for a reaction.
Approved. If you can figure a payroll-neutral way to bring it off.
That's easy, Jack, Clark observed with a chuckle. Fire 2,000 desk weenies and you still save money.
They're people with families, John, the president told him.
The directorates of intelligence and administration are feather-bedded all to hell and gone.
You've been there. You know that. It's worth doing just to ease the parking situation. Early retirement will handle most of it.
Ryan thought that one over for a second.
I need somebody to swing the axe. MP, can you handle being under Ed again?
It's the usual position, Jack, Mrs. Foley replied with a twinkle in her fey blue eyes. Ed's better at administration than I am, but I was always better in the street.
Plan Blue?
Clark answered that.
Yes, sir. I want us to go after cops, young detectives, regular blue suits.
You know why? They're largely pre-trained. They have street smarts.
Ryan nodded.
Okay. Mary Pat, next week I'm going to accept with regret the resignation letter of the DCI and appoint Ed in his place. Have him present me with a plan for increasing the DO and decreasing the DI and DA. I will approve that in due course.
Great!
Mrs. Foley toasted her commander-in-chief with her wine glass.
There's one other thing, John.
Yes, sir?
When Roger asked me to step up, I had a request for him.
What's that?
I'm going to issue a presidential pardon for a gentleman named John T. Kelly. That will be done this year. You should have told me that Dad worked your case.
For the first time in a very long time, Clark went pale as a ghost.
How did you know?
It was in Jim Greer's personal files.
They were sort of conveyed to me a few years ago. My father worked the case, I remember it well. All those women who were murdered. I remember how twisted he was about it, and how happy he was to put it behind him. He never really talked about that one, but I knew how he felt about it.
Jack looked down into his drink, swirling the ice around the glass.
If you want a good guess, I think he'd be happy about this. And I think he'd be happy to know you didn't go down with the ship.
Jesus, Jack. I mean, Jesus.
You deserve to have your name back.
I can't condone the things you did. I'm not allowed to think that way now, am I?
Maybe as a private citizen I could.
But you deserve your name back, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, sir.
Chavez wondered what it was all about. He remembered that guy on Saipan, the retired Coast Guard chief, and a few words about killing people. Well, he knew Mr. C didn't faint at the thought, but this story must be a good one.
Anything else? Jack asked. I'd like to get back to my family before all the kids go to bed.
Plan Blue is approved, then?
Yes, it is, MP,
as soon as Ed writes up a plan for implementing it.
I'll have him heading back as soon as they can light up his airplane, MP promised.
Fine. Jack rose and headed for the door. His guests did the same.
Mr. President?
It was Ding Chavez. Ryan turned. Yeah?
What's going to happen with the primaries?
What do you mean?
I stopped over at school today, and Dr. Alford told me that all of the serious candidates in both parties were killed last week, and the filing deadlines for all the primaries have passed. Nobody new can file. We have an election year, and nobody's running. The press hasn't said much about that yet.
Even Agent Price blinked at that, but an instant later they all knew it was true.
Paris? Professor Rousseau at the Pasteur Institute thinks he's developed a treatment. It's experimental, but it's the only chance she has.
They spoke in the corridor outside Sister Jean-Baptiste's room, both wearing blue plastic spacesuits and sweating inside of them despite the environmental control packs that hung on the belts. Their patient was dying, and while that was bad enough, the manner of her protracted death would be horrid beyond words. Benedict Macusa had been fortunate. For some reason or other, the Ebola had attacked his heart earlier than usual. It had been a rare act of mercy, which allowed the boy to expire much more quickly than usual. This patient wasn't quite so lucky. Blood tests showed that her liver was being attacked, but slowly. Heart enzymes were actually normal. Ebola was advancing within her body at a rapid but uniform rate. Her gastrointestinal system was quite literally coming apart. The resulting bleeding, both from vomiting and diarrhea, was serious, and the pain from it was intense. But the woman's body was fighting back as best it could in a valiant but doomed effort to save itself. The only reward for that struggle would be increasing pain, and already the morphine was losing its battle to stay ahead of the agony.
But how would we...
She didn't have to go on. Air Afrique had the only regular service to Paris, but neither that carrier nor any other would transport an Ebola patient for the obvious reasons. All of this suited Dr. Moody just fine.
I can arrange transport. I come from a wealthy family. I can have a private jet come in and fly us to Paris. It's easier to take all of the necessary precautions that way.
I don't know. I'll have to...
Maria Magdalena hesitated.
I will not lie to you, sister. She will probably die in any case. But if there is any chance, it is with Professor Rousseau. I studied under him, and if he says he has something, then he does. Let me call for the aircraft, he insisted.
I cannot say no to that, but I must...
I understand.
The aircraft in question was a Gulfstream G-4, and it was just landing at Rashid Airfield, located to the east of a wide, meandering loop of the River Tigris, known locally as the Nardula. The registration code near the aircraft's tail denoted Swiss registry, where it was owned by a corporation that traded in various things and paid its taxes on time, which ended official interest on the part of the Swiss government. The flight in had been short and unremarkable, except perhaps for the time of day, and the routing, Beirut to Tehran to Baghdad. His real name was Ali Badrine, and while he'd lived and worked under several other names, he'd finally returned to his own because it was Iraqi in origin. His family had left Iraq for the supposed economic opportunity in Jordan, but then been caught up, like everyone else, in the region's turmoil. A situation not exactly helped by their son's decision to become part of the movement which would put an end to Israel. The threat perceived by the Jordanian king and his subsequent expulsion of the threatening elements had ruined Badrine's family, not that he'd especially cared at the time. Badrine cared now somewhat. The life of a terrorist paled with the accumulating years, and though he was one of the best in that line of work, especially at gathering information, he had little to show for it beyond the undying enmity of the world's most ruthless intelligence service.
A little comfort and security would have been welcome. Perhaps this mission would allow that. His Iraqi identity and the activities of his life had garnered him contacts throughout the region. He'd provided information for Iraqi intelligence and helped finger two people they had wished to eliminate, both successfully. That had given him entree, and that was why he'd come. The aircraft finished its rollout, and the co-pilot came aft to lower the steps. A car pulled up. He entered it, and it pulled off. "Peace be with you," he told the other man in the back of the Mercedes.
"Peace," the general snorted. "The whole world cries out that we have little enough of that."
Clearly the man hadn't slept since the death of his president, Badrine saw. His hand shook from all the coffee he'd drunk, or perhaps from the alcohol he'd used to counteract it. It would not be a pleasant thing to look into the coming week and wonder if one would live to see the end of it. On the one hand, one needed to stay awake. On the other, one needed to escape. This general had a family and children in addition to his mistress. Well, they probably all did. Good.
"Not a happy situation, but things are under control, yes?"
The look this question generated was answer enough. About the only good thing that could be said was that had the president merely been wounded, this man would now be dead for failing to detect the assassin. It was a dangerous job, being intelligence chief for a dictator, and one which made many enemies. He'd sold his soul to the devil and told himself that the debt would never be collected. How could a bright man be such a fool?
"Why are you here?" the general asked. "To offer you a golden bridge."
Chapter 13 To the Manor Born. There were tanks in the streets, and tanks were sexy things for the overhead imagery people to look at and count. There were three KH-11-class reconnaissance satellites in orbit. One of them, 11 years old, was dying slowly. Long since out of maneuvering fuel and with one of its solar panels degraded to the point that it could barely power a flashlight, it could still take photos through three of its cameras and relay them to the geosynchronous communications bird over the Indian Ocean. Less than a second later, they were downlinked and forwarded to various interpretation offices, one of them at CIA.
That ought to cut down on purse snatchings.
The analyst checked his watch and added 8 hours. Okay, approaching 10 a.m., Lima, or local time. People should have been out on the streets, working, moving around, socializing at the many sidewalk restaurants, drinking the awful local version of coffee. But not today. Not with tanks in the streets. A few individuals were moving around, mainly women by the look of them, probably shopping. A main battle tank was parked about every 4 blocks on the main thoroughfares, and one at every traffic circle, of which there were many, supported by lighter vehicles on the side streets. Little knots of soldiers stood at every intersection. The photos showed that all of them carried rifles, but couldn't determine rank or discern unit patches.
"Get a count," his supervisor instructed.
"Yes, sir."
The analyst didn't grumble. Counting the tanks was something they always did. He'd even typed them, mainly by checking the main gun. By doing this, they'd be able to determine how many of the tanks regularly counted in their regimental loggers had turned their engines over and moved from one place to another. The information had importance to someone or other, though for the past 10 years they'd been doing the same thing, generally to learn that whatever the faults and flaws of the Iraqi military, it did its maintenance well enough to keep the engines running. It was rather less diligent about its gunnery, which they'd learned in the Persian Gulf War. But as the analyst had already noted, you look at a tank and assume that it works. It was the only prudent course. He hunched down over the viewer and saw that a white car, probably a Mercedes from the shape, was driving up National Route 7. A more detailed look at the photos would have showed it heading towards the Shibak al-Mansur racetrack, where he would have seen more automobiles of the same type. But he'd been told to count the tanks.
Iraq's climatic variations are more striking than in most places in the world. This February morning, with the sun high in the sky, it was barely above freezing, though in the summer 115 degrees Fahrenheit attracted little in the way of notice. The assembled officers, Bedrine saw, were in their winter wool uniforms, with high collars and voluminous gold braid. Most of them were smoking, and all of them were worried. His host introduced the visitor to those who didn't know him. He didn't bother wishing peace unto them. They weren't in the mood for the traditional Islamic greeting. These men were surprisingly Western and totally secular in their outlook and demeanor. Like their departed leader, they gave mere lip service to their religion, though at the moment they all wondered if the teachings of eternal damnation for a sinful life were true or not, knowing that some of them would probably find out soon enough. That possibility worried them enough that they had left their offices and come to the racetrack to hear him speak. The message Bedrine had to deliver was a simple one. This he did. "How can we believe you?" the army chief asked when he'd finished. "It is better for everyone this way, is it not?" "You expect us to abandon our motherland to him?" a corps commander demanded, disguising frustration as anger. "What you decide to do is your concern, General. If you desire to stand and fight for what is yours, the decision is clearly yours as well. I was asked to come here and deliver a message as an honest broker." "This I have done," Bedrine replied evenly. There was no sense getting excited about things like this after all. "With whom are we supposed to negotiate?" This was the chief of the Iraqi Air Force. "You may make your reply to me, but as I have already told you, there really is nothing to negotiate. The offer is a fair one, is it not?" "Generous would be a better term. In addition to saving their own skins, and the skins of those close to them, they would all emerge from their country wealthy. Their president had salted away huge sums of money, little of which had ever actually been detected and seized. They all had access to travel documents and passports from any country in the known world. In that particular area, the Iraqi intelligence service, assisted by the engraving bureau of its treasury, had long since established its expertise. You have his word before God that you will not be harassed, wherever you may go." And that was something they had to take seriously. Bedrine's sponsor was their enemy. He was as bitter and spiteful as any man on earth. But he was also a man of God, and not one to invoke his name lightly.
"When do you need your reply?" the army chief asked, more politely than the others. "Tomorrow would be sufficient, or even the day after. Beyond that I cannot say." "My instructions," Bedrine went on, "go only that far."
"And the arrangements?"
"You may set them yourselves, within reason."
Bedrine wondered how much more they could possibly expect from him or his sponsor. But the decision he demanded was harder than one might imagine. The patriotism of the assembled general officers was not of the usual sort. They loved their country largely because they controlled it. They had power, genuine life-and-death power, a far greater narcotic than money, and one of the things for which a man would risk his life and his soul. One of their number, many of them thought, hoped, just might pull it off. One of them just might assume the presidency of their country successfully, and together they just might calm things down and continue as before.
They'd have to open their nation up somewhat, of course. They'd have to allow UN and other inspectors to see everything. But with the death of their leader, they'd have the chance to start anew, even though everyone would know that nothing new at all was happening. Such were the rules of the world. A promise here or there, a few remarks about democracy and elections, and their former enemies would fall all over themselves, giving them and their nation a chance. A further incentive was the sheer opportunity of it. Not one of them had felt truly secure in years. Everyone knew of colleagues who had died, either at the hands of their dead leader, or under circumstances euphemistically called mysterious. Helicopter crashes had been a favorite ploy of their fallen and beloved president.
Now they had a chance to live lives of power with much greater confidence, and against that was a life of indolence in some foreign place. Each of them already had a life of every luxury a man could imagine, plus power. Each could snap his fingers, and the people who jumped were not servants, but soldiers. Except for one thing. To stay would be the greatest and most dangerous gamble of their lives. Their country was now under the strictest control they could remember, and there was a reason for it. The people who'd roared their love and affection for the dead one, what did they really think? It hadn't mattered a week before, but it mattered now. The soldiers they commanded came from the same human sea. Which of them had the charisma to assume the leadership of the country? Which of them had the keys to the Ba'at party? Which of them could rule by the force of will? Because only then could they look into the future, if not without fear, then with a small enough quantity of it that their experience and courage could deal with the chances they would be taking. Each of them, standing at the racetrack, looked around the assembly of brother officers and wondered the same question. Which one? That was the problem. Because if there had been one of their number to do it, he would already have been dead, probably in a tragic helicopter mishap. And a dictatorship was not operated by a committee. Strong as they all felt themselves to be, each looked at the others and saw potential weakness. Private jealousies would destroy them. Jockeying and rivalries would, probably, cause such internal turmoil that the iron hand needed to control the people would weaken. And in a few months, probably, it would come apart. They had all seen it happen before. And the ultimate result was foretold in their deaths, standing before a line of their own soldiers and a wall to their backs. There was no ethos for these men other than power and its exercise. That sufficed for one man, but not for many. Many needed to be unified around something, whether it be the rule imposed by one superior, or a commonly held idea, but it had to be something that imposed a common outlook. No one of them could do the former, and collectively they lacked the latter. Powerful as they each might be, they were also weak in a fundamental way. And as the officers stood there, looking around at one another, they all knew it. At base, they believed in nothing. What they enforced with weapons, they could not impose with will. They could command from behind, but not lead from the front. At least, most of them were intelligent enough to know it. That was why Badrine had flown to Baghdad. He watched their eyes and knew what they were thinking, however impassive their faces might have been. A bold man would have spoken up with confidence and thus assumed leadership of the group. But the bold ones were long since dead, cut down by one bolder and more ruthless, only to be cut down by the unseen hand of someone more patient and more ruthless still, enough so that he could now make a generous offer. Badrine knew what the answer had to be, and so did they. The dead Iraqi president had left nothing behind to replace himself, but that was the way of men who believed in nothing except themselves. The phone rang at 6:05 this time. Ryan didn't mind awakening before 7. It had been his custom for years, but back then he'd had to drive into work. Now the job was an elevator ride away, and he'd expected that the time previously spent in a car could now be spent in bed. At least he'd been able to doze in the back of his official car. "Yes?" "Mr. President?" Jack was surprised to hear Arnie's voice. Even so, he was tempted to demand who the hell else would pick the phone up.
"What is it?"
"Trouble." Vice President Edward J. Keelty had not slept all night, but one would not have known it from looking at him. Shaved pink, clear of eye, and straight of back, he strode into the CNN building with his wife and his aides, there to be met by a producer who whisked him into an elevator for the trip upstairs. Only the usual pleasantries were exchanged. The career politician just stared forward as though trying to convince the stainless steel doors that he knew what he was about, and succeeding.
The preparatory calls had been made over the previous 3 hours, starting with the head of the network. An old friend, the TV executive, had been thunderstruck for the first time in his career. One halfway expected airplane crashes, train wrecks, violent crimes, the routine disasters and sorrows from which the media made its living, but something like this was the occurrence of a lifetime. 2 hours earlier, he'd called Arnie Van Dam, another old friend, because one had to cover one's bases as a reporter. Besides, there was also a love of country in him that he rarely expressed, but it was there nonetheless. And the CNN president didn't have a clue where this story would go. He'd called on the network's legal correspondent, a failed trial attorney, who in turn was now on the phone with a professor friend at Georgetown University Law School. Even now, the CNN president called into the green room. "Are you really sure, Ed?" was all he had to ask. "I don't have a choice. I wish I didn't have to." Which was the expected answer. "Your funeral. I'll be watching." And the line went dead. At the far end, there was a form of rejoicing. It would be a hell of a story, and it was CNN's job to report the news, and that was that. "Arnie, is this totally crazy, or am I still dreaming?" They were in an upstairs sitting room. Jack had thrown on some casual clothes. Van Dam didn't have his tie on yet, and his socks were mismatched, Ryan noticed. Worst of all, Van Dam looked rattled, and he'd never seen that before. "I guess we'll just have to wait and see." Both men turned when the door opened. "Mr. President?" A 50-ish man came in, properly dressed in a business suit. He was tall and harried-looking. Andrea followed him in. She, too, had been briefed insofar as that was possible. "This is Patrick Martin," Arnie said. "Criminal Division of Justice, right?" Jack rose to shake hands and waved him to the coffee tray. "Yes, sir. I've been working with Dan Murray on the crash investigation. Pat's one of our better trial lawyers. He also lectures at George Washington on constitutional law," the chief of staff explained. "So, what do you think of all this?" the president asked, his voice still somewhere between whimsy and outright disbelief. "I think we need to see what he has to say." The quintessential lawyer's reply. "How long at Justice?" Jack asked next, returning to his seat. 23 years. 4 years in the FBI before that." Martin poured a cup and decided to stand. "Here we go," Van Dam observed, unmuting the TV. "Ladies and gentlemen, with us here in our Washington Bureau is Vice President Edward J. Kealty." CNN's chief political correspondent also looked as though he'd been dragged from his bed and genuinely shaken. Ryan noted that of all the people he'd seen that day, Kealty looked the most normal. "Sir, you have something unusual to say." "Yes, I do, Barry. I probably need to start by saying that this is the most difficult thing I've ever had to do in over 30 years of public life." Kealty's voice was quiet and restrained, speaking in the tone of an essay by Emerson, slow and clear, and painfully earnest. "As you know, President Durling asked me to resign from my post. The reason for this was a question of my conduct while a senator. Barry, it's no secret that my personal conduct has not always been as exemplary as it should have been. That's true of many people in public life, but it's no excuse, and I do not claim that it is. When Roger and I discussed the situation, we agreed that it would be best for me to resign my office, allowing him to select a new running mate for the elections later this year. It was his further intention to have John Ryan fill my post as interim vice president. Barry, I was content with that. I've been in public life for a very long time, and the idea of retiring to play with my grandchildren and maybe teach a little bit actually looked pretty attractive. And so I agreed to Roger's request in the interests of, well, really, for the good of the country. But I never actually resigned." "Okay," the correspondent said, holding his hands up as though to catch a baseball. "I think we need to be really clear on this, sir. What exactly did happen?" "Barry, I drove over to the State Department.
You see, the Constitution specifies that when the President or Vice President resigns, the resignation is presented to the Secretary of State. I met with Secretary Hansen privately to discuss the issue. I actually had a letter of resignation prepared, but it was in the wrong form, and Brett asked me to redraft it. So I drove back, thinking that I could have it done and resubmitted the following day. None of us expected the events of that evening. I was badly shaken by them, as were many. In my case, as you know, well, so many of the friends with whom I'd worked for years were just snuffed out by that brutal and cowardly act. But I never actually resigned my office. Keelty looked down for a moment, biting his lip before going on. Barry, I would have been content even with that. I gave my word to President Durling, and I had every intention of keeping it. But I can't. I just can't, Keelty went on. Let me explain. I've known Jack Ryan for 10 years. He's a fine man, a courageous man, and he served our country honorably. But he is, unfortunately, not the man to heal our country. What he said last night, trying to speak to the American people, proves it. How can we possibly expect our government to work under these circumstances without experienced, capable people to fill the offices left vacant? But he is the president, isn't he? Barry asked, scarcely believing what he was doing and what he was hearing. Barry, he doesn't even know how to do a proper investigation. Look at what he said last night about the plane crash. Hardly a week has passed, and already he says he knows what happened. Can anyone believe that? Keelty asked plaintively. Can anyone really believe that? Who has oversight over this investigation? Who's actually running it? To whom are they reporting? And to have conclusions in a week? How can the American people have confidence in that? When President Kennedy was assassinated, it took months. The investigation was run by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Why? Because we had to be sure, that's why. Excuse me, Mr. Vice President, but that doesn't really answer my question. Barry, Ryan was never Vice President because I never resigned. The post was never vacant, and the Constitution allows only one Vice President. He never even took the oath associated with the office. But you think I want to do this? I don't have a choice. How can we rebuild the Congress and the executive branch with amateurs? Last night, Mr. Ryan told the governors of the states to send him people with no experience in government. How can laws be drafted by people who don't know how? Barry, I've never committed public suicide before. It's like being one of the people, one of the senators at the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson. I'm looking down into my open political grave, but I have to place the country first. I have to. The camera zoomed in on his face, and the anguish there was manifest. One could almost see tears in his eyes as his voice proclaimed his selfless patriotism. He was always good on TV, Van Damme noted. I do have trouble believing all this, Ryan said after a moment. Believe it, Arnie told him. Mr. Martin, we could use some legal guidance. First of all, get someone over to state and check the secretary's office out. FBI? Van Damme asked. Yes, Martin nodded. You won't find anything, but that's how it has to start. Next, check phone logs and notes. Next, we start interviewing people. That's going to be a problem. Secretary Hansen's dead, along with his wife, and President and Mrs. Durling, of course. Those are the people most likely to have knowledge on the facts of the issue. I would expect that we will develop very little hard evidence and not very much useful circumstantial evidence. Roger told me that... Martin cut him off. Hearsay. You're telling me that someone said to you what he was told by somebody else. Not much use in any court of law. Go on, Arnie said. Sir, there really is no constitutional or statutory law on this question. And there's no Supreme Court to rule on the issue, Ryan pointed out. To that pregnant pause, he added, What if he's telling the truth?
"Mr. President, whether or not he's telling the truth is really beside the point," Martin replied. "Unless we can prove that he's lying, which is unlikely, then he has a case of sorts. By the way, on the issue of the Supreme Court, assuming that you get a new Senate and make your nominations, all of the new justices would ordinarily have to recuse themselves because you selected them. That probably leaves no legal solution possible."
"But if there's no law on this issue, the President, was he?" asked.
"Exactly. This is a beauty," Martin said quietly, trying to think. "Okay, a president or vice president stops holding office when he or she resigns. Resignation happens when the office holder conveys the instrument of resignation, a letter suffices, to the proper official. But the man who accepted the instrument is dead, and we will doubtless find that the instrument is missing. Secretary Hansen probably called the president to inform him of the resignation."
"He did," Van Damme confirmed.
"But President Durling is also dead. His testimony would have had evidentiary value, but that isn't going to happen either. That puts us back to square one." Martin didn't like what he was doing, and he was having enough trouble trying to talk and think about the law at the same time. This was like a chessboard with no squares, just the pieces arrayed at random. "But the phone logs will show there was a call, fine. Secretary Hansen might have said that the letter was poorly worded and would be fixed the following day. This is politics, not law. So long as Durling was president, Keelty had to leave because of the sexual harassment investigation." Arnie was getting it now. "You got it. His TV statement even covered that, and he did a nice job of neutralizing the issue, didn't he?"
"We're back to where we started," Ryan observed.
"Yes, Mr. President."
That elicited a wry smile.
"Nice to know that somebody believes." Inspector O'Day and three other agents from Headquarters Division left their car right in front of the building. When a uniformed guard came over to object, O'Day just flashed his ID and kept on going. He stopped at the main security desk and did the same. "I want your chief to meet me on the 7th floor in 1 minute," he told the guard. "I don't care what he's doing. Tell him to come up right now." Then he and his team walked to the elevator bank.
Pat, what the hell?"
The other three had been picked more or less at random from the Bureau's Office of Professional Responsibility. That was the FBI's own internal affairs department. All experienced investigators with supervisory rank, their job was to keep the Bureau clean. One of them had even investigated a former director. OPR's charter was to respect nothing but the law. And the surprising thing was that, unlike similar organizations in city police forces, it retained, for the most part, the respect of the street agents. The lobby guard had called ahead to the guard post on the top floor. It was George Armitage this morning, working a different shift from the previous week. "FBI," O'Day announced as the elevator door opened. "Where's the secretary's office?"
"This way, sir."
Armitage led them down the corridor.
"Who's been using the office?" the inspector asked.
"We're getting ready to move Mr. Adler in. We've just about got Mr. Hansen's things out, and..."
"So people have been going in and out?"
"Yes, sir." O'Day hadn't expected that it would be much use bringing in the forensics team, but that would be done anyway. If there had ever been an investigation that had to go strictly by the book, this was the one.
"Okay, we need to talk to everyone who's been in or out of the office since the moment Secretary Hansen left it. Every single one, secretaries, janitors, everybody."
"The secretarial staff won't be in for another half hour or so."
"Okay. You want to unlock the door?"
Armitage did so, letting them into the secretary's room, and then through the next set of doors into the office itself. The FBI agent stopped cold there, the four of them just looking at it first. Then one of them took post at the door to the main corridor.
"Thank you, Mr. Armitage," O'Day said, reading the name tag.
"Okay, for the moment, we're treating this as a crime scene. Nobody in or out without our permission. We need a room where we can interview people. I'd like you to make a written list of everyone you know to have been in here, with date and time, if that's possible.
Their secretaries will have that.
We want yours, too.
O'Day looked up the corridor and was annoyed.
We asked your department chief to join us. Where do you suppose he is?
He usually doesn't get in until 8 or so.
Could you call him, please? We need to talk to him right now.
You got it, sir.
Armitage wondered what the hell